Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb with WCQS News. You're about to hear the full remarks given by Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Kaine at the campus of UNC Asheville Wednesday, October 19th, one day before the start of early voting in North Carolina.
Hey, Asheville, how you guys doing? Wow, what a great crowd. Man, this is fantastic. They told me we were going to have a good crowd here, but this is really unbelievable. Thank you so much. How about Michael? Didn't he do a great job? We've got a great group of folks who've already appeared before you. Let me just talk about some of them and thank them. Michael is a student here. I want to thank your chancellor, Mary Grant, and all the faculty, staff, and students for hosting. This is a great institution. UNC Asheville, a great institution. And I think it's really an exciting thing to do in the closing stretch of a presidential campaign to open up opportunities like this for the student and the community. So I thank the university for it. We had two beautiful young ladies, Lizzie and Tess, did our Pledge of Allegiance. I took a picture with them. Your mayor, Esther Mannheimer, is doing a great job. You heard from Ronald Davia, who's a coordinated campaign guy, and your state rep, Susan Fisher. And then I had a chance to visit earlier with State Senator Terry Van Dyne, Brian Turner, and John Ager. So we have some great elected officials in the House. Hey, what day does early voting start in North Carolina? Tomorrow, that's right. Early voting starts tomorrow, and that's why we're here. Early voting, 17 days of early vote between tomorrow and the 5th of November, which makes it so very, very convenient, so much more convenient than if it's just on one day. And we are encouraging everybody who can to vote early. That will enable us to organize. That will enable us to maximize participation and make sure that the result here in North Carolina is a clear mandate, and a clear mandate for Hillary Clinton for president. We're so very, very excited. You have also got very important races for Congress, for the governor's race, for the U.S. Senate. And the better we do, the more people we get in office who will represent your progressive values. That's why this race is so important, and that's why you're so important in North Carolina. So let's make sure that we go out and we win for everybody. You guys are important. North Carolina is a battleground state. You are a classic close state. In 2008. North Carolina voted for President Obama. In 2012, North Carolina voted for Mitt Romney. So this is a state where it's right on the bubble. We have some experience with that in Virginia. It's right on the bubble, and the polls are close. And so that's why I'm here. My wife Ann and I have been in North Carolina often since I came onto the ticket. Hillary called me at July 22nd, 7:32 p.m., not that it was memorable. To ask me to be her running mate, and we have been in North Carolina a lot because you are really important. North Carolina is one of a few what I call checkmate states, which is if you do what you can do and we win North Carolina, there is zero path for Donald Trump to be president of the United States. And so if you're an early to bed type and you don't want to stay up for mountain time or Pacific time to know who the next president is, I got good news for you. You hold this election right in your own hands. If you do what you know how to do and what you have done in North Carolina and we win here, this race is going to be set for Hillary Clinton and me, and it's really, really good to come and just chat with you about it. What I hoped I would do a little bit here in Asheville is talk about the debate tonight. Anybody excited about it? Yeah. Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit about the debate. I want to talk about why Hillary and I are in this race, the issues that we care about. I'll draw a little bit of a contrast then with Donald Trump and the vision that he has for the country. And then finally, I'll close with how are we going to win this thing? How are we going to win it? Let's start talking about the debate. Hasn't Hillary done wonderful in the first two debates? I mean, Hillary... HRC, that's right. Hillary has done so well. And remember, the day of the first debate, September 26th, the polls nationally were tied. Hillary and I came out of the Philadelphia convention with a lead, lasted till Labor Day, and then it just kind of whittled down. September 26th, this race was a dead heat race. So the pressure was on, and the stakes were high. But something I know about Hillary is when the pressure is on and the stakes are high and the spotlights are bright, she does her best work. And that night, she really showed the nation what a president looks like. She was prepared. I mean, it was obvious. It was obvious if you just looked at the content of the answers that Hillary is so prepared. Her great track record of public service has enabled her to talk with knowledge, experience, and passion about all the issues, and she did that. But the thing that I liked the best in some ways in both the first and second debate was just how presidential she is. Cool, under pressure, calm, poised, in interacting with the citizens in that town hall format, you know, a warm and friendly person, as I know her to be. And that was such a sharp contrast. That calm presidential demeanor, the steadiness of the judgment, such a sharp contrast with Donald Trump, who comes in very volatile, who kind of always wants to do something scorched earth and pull some stunt or pull some surprise. He'll probably try more of those tonight. But I think what you'll see tonight is, again, preparation and grace and calm and judgment. And you will then see, Donald Trump. You will see then Donald Trump. You know what? This guy's had a bad last couple of weeks. Got to have some sympathy for him, right? Got to have some sympathy for him. And so I think, you know, you're going to see the kind of wild stuff from Donald Trump and maybe some of his followers. But that is a sharp contrast. Because how do you want to see the country governed? I'll tell you what, my favorite moment of the debates were so far, and I even think, after tonight, this is still going to be my favorite moment. At the end of the first debate, the moderator, Lester Holt, asked a question of Donald Trump about something negative he had said about Hillary. And I think what he was asked about was this comment, "She doesn't look very presidential, does she, fellas?" And he asked Trump about it. Is that a comment on Hillary's looks? Is that a comment on her gender? And Trump tried to kind of spin out of it, saying, "No, I was commenting on her stamina." Do you remember what Hillary said? It's a split screen, so you're seeing Trump's face and Hillary's face. And Hillary said, "You go to 120 countries and you testify before Congress for 11 hours, and then you can come talk to me about stamina." And she said it in such a energized way. I'm cool, calm, and collected. If the moderator right then had said, "Hey, let's extend this debate another 5 or 6 hours," Hillary would have said, "I'm right with you. Let's go. Let's do it right now." But on the other side of the screen, as Hillary was saying that, it was just like Donald was leaning over. It was like there was a lamppost he was leaning against. He had run out of gas. He didn't have the stamina that night. And so anyway, I'm really proud about Hillary and the campaign she's run. I'm proud of these debates. And I think you see in these debates who is somebody who can be presidential. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. And I hope everybody has a chance to watch this tonight. I'm excited to be watching it. Let me tell you about why we're in this race, Hillary and me. And maybe the way I'll do it is this. Let me tell you what Hillary said to me when she called and asked if I would be a running mate. Because what she said to me tells you about her. Tells you about the way she's thinking about the job. She called me that night and she said, "Hey, I've decided I want you to be my running mate in this race." And I started to say yes. I was so excited to say yes. She said, "Wait a minute. Let me tell you why first." She said, "Just hold on a second. Don't be so anxious. I want to tell you why." And this tells you about Hillary. She said, "You've been a missionary and a civil rights lawyer and a city councilman and mayor and a lieutenant governor and governor and a senator. You've been at all the levels. What I want for my administration," this is Hillary speaking, "is I want to make sure we measure ourselves the right way. I don't think it's going to be about a bill. I don't think it's going to be about a headline. I don't think it's supposed to be about a soundbite. I think it's supposed to be about, can we make a classroom a better learning environment for a teacher or a kid? Can we enable a business to hire a few more employees? Can we make a family a little more secure that their kids have health insurance? Can we enable workers to get skills? Can we enable students and families to not have so much debt? The thing about our administration is we got to measure it by the real difference, the practical difference we make in the lives of individuals." And she said, "Because you've been at these levels, I think you will help us remember to measure what we do the right way and not the wrong way." Well, that's obviously so humbling to hear that. Somebody thinks that I could help them to do that. But But that's why Hillary and I are in this. Her background from civil rights through public service, my background in civil rights in Virginia for 17 years and then public service, it's all been about trying to help other people. And there's a lot of folks and a lot of communities and a lot of industries that need help. And that's why Hillary and I are running this race. And that's how we're going to measure success. Now, there are some important differences between the tickets. And I'm going to do like about a 45-second riff on a number, but then I'm going to dig into just a few. Because there are vast differences between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on the issues. And that's what matters in a race. Character matters and issues matter. There's a vast difference in character. Hillary puts others first. Donald puts himself first. There's a vast difference in issues. Do you believe in LGBT equality? If you do, Hillary Clinton and I are with you, but the other guys are against. The other guys want to roll that back. Do you believe in climate science or don't you? Hillary Clinton and I do, and the other guys don't. Do you think women should get paid equal for equal work? Hillary and I believe that. The other guys don't. You think women should be able to make their own health decisions, including reproductive health? Hillary and I do, and the other guys don't. You think we ought to raise the minimum wage? Hillary and I do, and the other guys don't. Do you think we need to tackle the cost of college and make it easier to afford college? Hillary and I have a plan to do that. The other guys don't. Do you think we ought to make it easier and more convenient to vote? Hillary and I believe that. The other guys want to make it harder. So there's a lot of issues that are pretty basic where, you know, we don't have to convince you what you think about equality. We don't have to convince you what you think about climate science. You know what you think. What we have to do is just explain the differences between a ticket that is with you on your core values and a ticket that would take us backward. So there's a lot of issues, but what I thought I would do after that little riff is just dig into just a couple. I want to talk about jobs. I want to talk about college costs, climate change. And then I also want to talk about taxes, just those four. Jobs. Hillary and I believe we got to create an economy that works for everybody, not just those at the top. Now, President Obama, to his credit, came in when the worst recession since the 1930s, right? We had lost 15 million jobs, and we were in a deep, deep recession. And President Obama came in. And this is a little bit of an indication of it. The other side wouldn't lift a finger to help them. GOP wouldn't lift a finger. We've added 15 million jobs. We've cut the unemployment rate in half. People's 401k policies are worth something again. And that's a president doing that without any help from the other side. But we also know that there's too many people who still don't see the ladder of success that they can climb. It might be because of the zip code you live in. It might be because of the industry that you trained in. And so the job that we have to do is take the progress that we're and the growth we're currently experiencing and accelerate it. We're going to do it by investing in research, in clean energy, in infrastructure, and manufacturing. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do it by making sure our workforce has the best skills possible, from pre-K to K-12 to higher ed to career and technical programs. We're going to do it by fairness policies, women getting equal pay for equal work, increasing the minimum wage so you are not below the poverty level when you work full-time. If you work right now in this country for minimum wage and you have a dependent, you will be below the poverty level. That's so unfair. We tell our kids, hard work is important. Hard work is important. But if we meant what we said, we would value work enough to have a salary level so that if you worked full-time and worked hard, you wouldn't be below the poverty level. And that's what we'll do if we have an opportunity to serve. And we will focus on where jobs come from. Where do jobs come from? Two-thirds of new jobs in this country come from small businesses. The small startups, you've got tons of them here in Asheville. This is a great community with a great startup community. I grew up in a house where my dad ran a welding and ironworking shop. 5 employees in a bad year, 10 in a good year, plus my brothers and me and my mom. Hillary's dad ran a small drapery business. This is the backbone of the American economy, and we want to make it easier to start small businesses, to hire employees, and to grow them and we've got a plan to do it. That is our focus on the economy, and that will create an economy that works for everybody. Donald Trump, his focus is tax cuts for the wealthiest, and he's even said American wages are too high. American wages aren't too high, they're too low, and so that's a clear difference between the two tickets. That's pillar one, an economy that works for everybody. I describe it as the difference between a you're hired president in Hillary Clinton and a you're fired president in Donald Trump. I mean, there is some poetic justice in that. As you think about Donald Trump, you know, what are the words that you associate with him? And I think when this thing is all said and done and Donald is back to hawking bottled water or something, the two things that we will remember about Donald Trump are you're fired. That's what we're going to remember about Donald Trump. Cost of college. Student loan debt is now greater than credit card debt in this country. And an awful lot of families, they can't figure out with their students how to afford college. The average student who has debt usually has debt of around $30,000, and that's difficult, and it's getting harder and harder and harder. Hillary and I have set a bold goal for this nation that we should be able to do college debt-free. There should be debt-free college. Other nations do this. And other nations that have less resources than us do this, and so that's something that we should do. In fact, if your family makes less than $125,000, what we're going to shoot for is tuition-free college. And that will be big. That will be a big thing to push. But why wouldn't we do this? We have free K through 12, and we do it, and we've done it for a long time because we believed everybody needed that to have the skills to be successful. We all know now that in today's economy, just stopping at 12th grade isn't going to be enough. You will need something after 12th grade. It doesn't have to be college. It can be college or community college. It can be a union apprenticeship program or a career and technical program. Our labor unions have done a great job of showing us the way to do that, and we can make those apprenticeship programs more available. But if we were willing to have education be free through 12th grade when that was sufficient to have a good job, now you need more, and we ought to be willing to invest in it. And this is something that Hillary and I are pushing. That plan doesn't help some who are here, because if you're out of college and you're dealing with debt, what I'm telling you about is a plan that's going to help the next group of college students. With student debt being so high, we have to create new means for people to be able to refinance their student loan debts to make the monthly payments more reasonable. Do you know this? Here is something really bizarre and outrageous about American law right now, and it is this. It is easier to refinance a loan on Donald Trump's jet than it is to refinance a student loan debt. We've put rules in place that make it very difficult to refinance student loan debt. You can refinance a loan on a vacation home. You can refinance one on a jet or a yacht. We should make it easier to refinance student loan debt, and we'll do that. This is our education plan. Now, Donald Trump is known for one thing in education, and that's Trump U. Hillary and I look at education, this is the path to individual success. This is the path for social success. Donald Trump looked out at the world as he was trying to amass his own fortune and said, I see education as about something else. I see education as a way for me to make a whole lot of money. And so he set up a non-accredited institution with a lot of slick marketing materials, and he taught the, quote, teachers to extract as much as they could out of the students' pockets, max your credit card debt, etc. Oh, veterans, they're people to go after because they have GI Bill benefits that you can go after. Oh, the spouses of deceased veterans, they have GI Bill benefits. You can go after that too. And thousands of people had their money taken and got something that wasn't even worth the paper it was written on, because Donald Trump had a very different idea about what education was. Don't you think we should have a president who understands that education is about lifting up individuals, lifting up our society, lifting up our economy, and not a president who views it as a ripoff and a money-making opportunity? Climate change. Here in North Carolina, in my home state of Virginia, climate change isn't a tomorrow issue, it's a today issue. the frequency of storms. Matthew has just hit this state bad, and the post-Matthew flooding killed dozens and dozens of people. And first responders acted in a heroic way, but we see these extreme storm events getting more and more frequent. It might be hurricanes on the East Coast or sea level rise or superstorms, but it's wildfires and droughts in other parts of the country. Hampton Roads, Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia Beach, second most active part of the country after New Orleans in terms of the effect of sea level rise. There's neighborhoods where 10 years ago, houses were buying and selling like hotcakes, where it's really difficult to sell a house now because the normal tidal action floods so often that your whole investment is kind of worthless. It's very, very hard to sell. And so we've got this problem, and we have to figure out how to do it. Now, here's something good about President Obama. He worked with a coalition of 197 nations to sign a climate deal in Paris where every nation is saying, this is a problem, the science is real, and we need to step up and take action to deal with climate. That is huge. It's hard to get Congress to pass a Mother's Day resolution. I mean, it's hard for Congress to pass a Mother's Day resolution. Try to get 197 nations to agree on anything. And Hillary and I believe in this science, and we want to move forward inventing the clean energy economy of tomorrow and doing the things that will save the planet in tandem with people around the world. Donald Trump says climate change is a hoax invented by the Chinese. And that is a quote. That is a quote from a book that he wrote. Mike Pence, the vice presidential nominee, says climate change is a myth. Donald Trump says he's going to tear up the climate accord the first day that he's in office. All that work of all these nations to try to deal with the problem so that our kids and grandkids can have a beautiful planet to live on, and Donald Trump says tearing it up on day one. We cannot afford to have an anti-science president. We got to have a pro-science president in Hillary Clinton. This is a pretty important one, because if you won't accept climate science, what other kind of science won't you accept? Science about brain development, science about water cleanliness, science about air cleanliness. If you reject climate science, this is just the beginning of a big, big problem. It's the tip of the iceberg, especially standing here on a university campus. I think we all know the stakes. We cannot put somebody in office who is anti-science. So these are some of the issues, and there's so many more that really motivate us, make us excited about this campaign. We also want to win because how you campaign is a little bit too about how you govern. We think we've run a campaign based on ideas and proposals that are out there, sometimes super wonky, a lot of details. Hey, I plead guilty to that, and Hillary does too. We think details matter. Details matter. If it's about your life, it's not a detail, it's a big deal, right? If it's about our country, it's not a detail, it's a big deal. We think details matter. We've got a lot of policies out there. Donald Trump's run a very different kind of campaign. It's been a campaign from the very first day about division. In his opening speech, I'm running for president, in that opening speech, he called Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals. And it has been one insult after another during the entire campaign against virtually every group in this country, going after immigrants, saying African Americans, quote, you are living in hell. Those are Donald Trump's words. And Donald Trump perpetrated the bigoted lie that President Obama is not a U.S. citizen for 5 years, when all the evidence had disproven him, when the president had already released two versions of his birth certificate, and Donald Trump was peddling this lie. And he said it so many times that people, Donald Trump's just saying something. Just stop and think about it for a minute, what Donald Trump was saying by saying that our first African-American president is not a citizen. I come from Virginia, the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond. And we have painful memories and painful scar tissue just like the rest of our country does. When you say about President Obama that he's not a citizen, that brings us back to the day when if you were an African American in this country, you could not be a citizen, even if you were born here, even if you were born free. Neither you nor your child nor your grandchild nor 10 generations out could be a citizen. That's what the Dred Scott decision said in the 1850s. Nobody of African descent living in this country, even having been here for hundreds of years, could be a citizen. So why would Donald Trump, when there was no evidence to support it, haul us back to that painful day and reopen that scar tissue to pitch the notion that the President of the United States is not a U.S. citizen. He hasn't apologized. He hasn't explained. He hasn't taken responsibility. This is just one of the many insults that Donald Trump has perpetrated. Latinos, immigrants, African Americans, the grossest statements, actions, and expression of values about women. The most recent controversy about Donald Trump's tape, his own words, and his actions are really a revelation of his heart. There's a great phrase from the Gospel of Matthew that says, "From the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaks." If you just listen to Donald Trump's words, this is what you are forced to conclude. He cannot look at a woman and see an equal. He can look at a woman and see sort of a half person, half object, but he cannot look at a woman and see an equal. There's just something missing in him that he's not able to do that. But he's insulted more people. He went after John McCain, for God's sake, a Senate colleague of mine who was a POW in Vietnam for years and said he wasn't a hero because he got captured. He went after a Virginia family from Charlottesville, the Khan family, who lost a son in the military, who was saving the lives of his colleagues in battle and lost his life. And when they challenged Donald Trump and said, "What you say about Muslims is wrong. We're Muslim American. Our son is, and he sacrificed himself to save Americans' lives." And then Donald Trump proceeded to ridicule them and go after them because of what they had said about him. He wants to make Muslims a second-class religion, either block them from coming into the United States or making them take some kind of a loyalty test that other people don't have to take in a nation that's dedicated to the proposition. It's in the First Amendment for a reason, folks, that you can worship in this country as you like or not, and you won't be preferred or punished for it. That's one of the greatest values that we have. And I'll tell you, at the end of the campaign, it's not enough to attack every group he can. Now he's deciding to attack American democracy itself. America cannot run a fair election, in the words of Donald Trump, a nation that stands as a beacon for other nations around the world. Donald Trump is now perpetrating the lie that, oh, the election is all set against me. We know what's going on. He's losing. He will never. Donald Trump has never been willing to take responsibility for anything. So it's not like he's going to stand up and say, "Well, I lost. I guess I must have run a divisive campaign that Americans didn't like." No. If he loses, it's going to be somebody else's fault. And so he's going around saying that the election is set against him. Can you think about that? A guy who wants to be president, so willing to attack the democratic institutions and the elections of this country, and you want to be president of the United States? I mean, this election is very existential. I'll just say it to you this way. Some elections are about the differences in candidates, and there's vast differences in Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, but some elections, few elections, every generation, or maybe they don't come along even that much, the election is more about the nation looking in a mirror and deciding what is it that we see there. This is a self-definition election. This is America saying to ourselves and the rest of the world, here's who we are. Are we going to hold fast to our principles of equality, hold fast to our principles of freedom of religious worship, or are we going to do a 180 and now be a society where it's okay to be a community of disrespect, where people are dissed because of their origin or because of their skin color, because of their sexual orientation, or because of their religion? There's only one answer to that question, folks. We've got to hold on to our values. We've got to keep orienting by that North Star of equality, and that's why we've got to elect Hillary Clinton. The stakes are so high. So, let me get to the last piece of this. How are we going to win? I talked about you guys as kind of a checkmate state. North Carolina will be key. If we win North Carolina, we win this race. So many of you have already volunteered. Raise your hand if you're volunteering, right? So give them a round of applause. That's a lot of good folks volunteering. If you want to volunteer in the next 20 days, together, text together to 47246, and you can do that. We would love to have your help here in Western North Carolina, or you may know people in other states you can call, but do your best work right here, because North Carolina is so close and it's going to be so very, very critical. I like the way it looks right now. You know, the polling looks pretty good, but the last thing I just kind of want to get into is let's just take nothing for granted. Take nothing for granted. Take nothing for granted. Take nothing for granted because we're living in a season of surprises. Some polls have been wrong. Some pundits have been wrong. We were ahead on Labor Day, and then it was tied on September 26th. That could happen again. Take nothing for granted. Take nothing for granted because we now know that the Russian government is trying to influence the outcome of this election in a way that we've never seen in the history of American elections. If there's another reason other than the candidates to participate in big numbers and send a clear message to any foreign country, don't try to mess with an American election. This is another reason to turn out strong. Take nothing for granted. Take nothing for granted because since we know Donald Trump will be whining and complaining when he loses, the bigger margin we have, the harder it is for any reasonable person to listen to one word of that nonsense that he's going to start to spew after Election Day. Take nothing for granted because the bigger the margin we win by, the more Democratic congressmen and women will elect, the more Democratic senators will elect, the more governors like Roy Cooper right here in North Carolina will elect. Take nothing for granted. And take nothing for granted for one last issue that's so important. Take nothing for granted for one last reason. Hillary is trying to do something that has never been done. Do you guys know that? Hillary is trying to do something that has never been done. If it had been easy to elect a woman president, there would have been a woman president. It has been hard, and Hillary's trying to make history, and making history isn't easy. I mean, this is important. Let me give you a fact. Everybody here knows we haven't had a woman president. But here's something else. Right now in Congress, today, U.S. Congress, 19% women, that's the best we've ever been, and that ranks us 75th in the world. But below the global average, give you some order of comparison. U.S. 19% women in our national legislative body. In Iraq, it's 26%. In Afghanistan, it's 28%. Number one is Rwanda, 64%. All over this globe, countries have done better than us. We're good at so many things, and we're good at so many things with respect to women. But part of being a great nation should be the willingness to look in the mirror and say, but we're not good at this, and we got to get better at this, and we're not good at electing women to federal office. So we can't take anything for granted because it's been hard to do what we're trying to do. Anybody out here in this crowd tried to do something for the first time in your family, in your neighborhood, in your workplace, where you go to school? I bet a lot of people here have tried to do something for the first time that was hard. How about this? Anybody out here ever tried to do something to follow a dream of yours and had somebody look at you and say, "Nah, that's probably not going to work out, or it's not your time, or somebody's more qualified than you, or you need to wait a little bit longer." Told you to maybe put some cold water on those dreams of yours. This was not going to happen. I bet everybody has had that experience at least once in life, and some of you probably had it a whole lot of times. And I'll tell you something interesting about that. That voice that says you probably are not going to be successful, this probably will not work for you, sometimes that's the voice of an adversary who doesn't want you to be successful. Sometimes it's the voice of a friend who doesn't want you to get your hopes up, doesn't want you to be disappointed. Sometimes that voice isn't outside at all. We all carry doubt within us. And just when we want to start to, you know, achieve our dreams, it's sometimes the inside voice that tells us, oh no, this probably isn't going to work out. Let me tell you something about my running mate, Hillary Clinton. She's heard that voice from others and probably from herself, because we all have, her entire life. She's had people tell her, you probably can't do this. This is a field that's for men, not women. the time isn't right for you, you're not likable enough, why don't you smile more, you don't look very presidential. She's heard this her entire life. She's had the headwind in her face her entire life. She knows what a tough battle this is, that it's still going to be tough over the next 20 days, that it'll be tough when she's governing, and that's why we can't take anything for granted. I'll give you one more thing about me and how I like to go into races, and the thought that I have in my mind as we get into the closing stretch. A good and a bad thing about me. The first is my good thing. I'm 8-0 in elections, and I'm going to be 9-0 on November 8th. I'm not going to lose. No, I'm not going to lose. I lose to my wife at Scrabble, and I lose to friends in baseball trivia, and don't take a stock tick from me. I mean, but when it comes to elections, I don't lose. I don't lose. Now, that's the good thing, but here's the bad thing. I barely win. I mean, in my races in Virginia, I barely win. And I always say when I'm on a college campus, and if you're thinking about, you know, careers, and you find that you're a barely likable enough person, you know, politics, I will tell you, you tell me another profession where 51% is a winner. You know, 51% can like you and 49% not. I'm like, wow, that's a really successful politician. That's really a winner. You can't get by with 51-49 in any other line of work. Now, I'm joking around a little bit about that. Why do I barely win my races? Because I run in tough real estate. Virginia's not the bluest state in the bunch. We're bluer now than we used to be. But when I got into politics in 1994, it's a tough place. So when I'm running contested races, I know I am running into a headwind. I know I'm running in a tough place. And the way that I win is I put a thought in my mind, and I want you to put this thought in your mind for the next 20 days so we can power through, take nothing for granted, and win a big history-making election. The thought I put in my mind is, you're the underdog until they call you the winner. Right? You're the underdog until they call you the winner. Don't believe a poll. Don't believe a nice editorial. You're the underdog until they call you the winner. And then that kind of puts you in the discipline mode where you make that extra 5 phone calls, or you knock on the extra 5 doors, or you sign up for a couple of extra volunteer shifts, and you keep doing it until the polls close. And only then do you get to watch and see what the outcome is. And if you approach it with that discipline, then they're going to call you the winner, because that's what it needs to win. And I'll tell you something else. This attitude is not just an election. This attitude is not just a thought about elections. It's a thought about life. I was chairman of the Democratic Party for 2.5 years, and I used to travel around the country going to Democratic Party meetings. And I tell you, we are a ragtag motley crew. I mean, and I say that with a lot of affection and love. Meetings are very different, and you know, we've got environmental activists and students and new American groups and people passionate about women's rights and people passionate about labor, and we all get along, but sometimes we're kind of a motley crew. Will Rogers in the 1920s said, "I don't believe in organized politics, that's why I'm a Democrat." I mean, it's kind of funny that 90 years ago, that still kind of has a little bit of ring of truth to it. But when I was traveling around the country doing this and going to these meetings here, there, and everywhere, I was trying to figure out, what is it that unites us? What is it that unites this party, which is the oldest continuously operating political party in the world? And going to all these meetings, about 1.5 years into it, I just suddenly got it. We're underdog people. I mean, for all of our quirks and differences, the thing that's cool about Democrats is that we're underdog people. We just have the sympathy and the goal to kind of root for and help out the underdog. Maybe a great researcher at UNC Asheville will determine that that's a DNA, you know, trait or something, but whatever it is, that's kind of who we are. In my church, the way we would say it is this. We would say it, we kind of use like the Good Samaritan phrase. Everybody knows the story, regardless of everybody's faith tradition. It's a beautiful story. Somebody's beaten up and lying at the side of the road, and they just need a hand. They just need a hand. And a whole lot of people just walk on by, including leaders, including religious people, including folks who should know better. When they're confronted with somebody lying at the side of the road who needs a hand, they just walk on by. I bet somebody walked on by and pointed at the poor person on the side of the road and said, "You're a loser," right? I bet somebody probably said that. But I don't know all of you. I know a few of you, don't know all of you, but you just don't strike me as the kind of people who walk on by. Now, then there was the Samaritan. And in the story, the Samaritan was kind of a despised minority figure, but he came over and he helped out. The thing I love about our party, the thing I love about our country, is I think we have a little bit of a disposition to not walk on by, but to just come over and help out. Sometimes we don't have all of the answers. Sometimes we don't have any of the answers. Sometimes we don't even know the words to say, but we have the instinct to roll up our sleeves and go over and help out. There's a lot of people in this country that are at the side of the road right now. There's a lot of people in this country that are at the side of the road right now. They may be victims of violence, or they may be battling hunger, or they may need an educational opportunity, or their business is struggling, or they're dealing with illness, or they're lonely and they just need a word of friendship or compassion, or they made a mistake when they were young and they're looking for somebody to just give them a second chance. There's a lot of people at the side of the road who are asking for our help. And it's a test. The test is, are you putting yourself first, or can you put somebody else first? I'm going to tell you something, folks. Hillary Clinton is not a person who will walk on by. She's going to go over and try to help somebody out. I'm not a person who's going to walk on by. I'm going to go over and try to help somebody else out. I think about you. You're not people who are going to walk on by in North Carolina, here in Asheville at the university. You're going to go over and try to help folks out. There's a lot of people out there who need us. They need a president who will listen and who has a heart that will respond, not a president who will always put himself first. That's the stakes on November 8. We have to get this right. And if you have that underdog mentality, we will get this right. We will make history. We'll elect Hillary Clinton, the first woman president of the United States. And then we will go on to be stronger together as a nation. Thank you so much, North Carolina. Thanks so much, Asheville. Let's go win.